Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, a spotlight on the ancient city of Aquileia. And the third and final part of our series, What is it like to come close to the presence of God? Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. A year ago, more or less, it was Saturday, 7th of May 2011, Pope Benedict XVI left the Vatican for a weekend visit to Aquileia and Venice. What I'd like to do in a few moments is shine the spotlight on the ancient city of Aquileia in northeastern Italy, not just because it's a year since the Pope visited, but because on the 13th of May, right until the 15th, the second Ecclesial Assembly of Aquileia is taking place there. I'd like to recall for a moment how when the Holy Father visited, he attended the preparatory assembly for this meeting in the Basilica there. On this occasion, he highlighted the pivotal role of the ancient Church of Aquileia in the evangelization of Central Europe. This is a translation of what he said in Italian.
It is appropriate that you wanted your ecclesial convention to take place in the Mother Church of Aquileia, from which the churches of the northeast of Italy have germinated, but also the churches of Slovenia and Austria, and some Croatian and Bavarian and even Hungarian churches.
Naturally, the Pope spoke too of the future of the region, of the mission of the northeast, where Christians have to face new challenges.
Coming back to Aquileia means, above all, learning from the glorious church which generated you, how to commit yourselves today in a world which is radically changed.
Come impegnarsi oggi in un mondo radicalmente cambiato.
To a renewed evangelization of your area.
Per una nuova evangelizzazione del vostro territorio.
And how to hand down to future generations the precious heritage of our Christian faith.
Anyway, what I'd like to do in a few moments is, rather than speak of the assembly itself, is highlight the Pope's words when he speaks of this meeting at Aquileia as a significant return to the roots in order to rediscover the living stones of the spiritual building that has its foundation in Christ and its extension in the most eloquent witnesses of the Aquilean Church. I'd like to do this by stepping back in time with Catherine McDonnell, who teaches Roman archaeology at the University of California, Los Angeles, in the United States. She was first attracted to this place, as archaeologists do, by stones. Stones with inscriptions, which speak to us of Aquileia's Christian legacy. But before we join her, I'd like to briefly put Aquileia on the map for you. Aquileia is on the River Aquila and is perhaps one of Italy's most hidden treasures, not just because of what you can see there, but also because of what you can't see. That's kind of an odd statement. I'll better explain. Founded in 181 BC as a strategic Roman fortress city built to defend boundaries on the one hand from the barbarians that came from the east, and on the other to defend the so-called Amber Road, which connected the Transalpine world with the sea. The reason there's still a lot you can't see here is because in this place most of what was here is so extended that much of it has not yet been excavated. Just think, in Roman times there was a forum, a circus, a theatre, and of course an amphitheatre. Not all is visible. What is in sight is the stone from the amphitheatre, which many centuries later the local inhabitants pilfered to build the bell tower of the ancient basilica that still stands there and that beckons from afar as you approach this site and its romantic ruins scattered around its cypress-lined lanes. Clearly, it's expensive to excavate an area as large as this. It's a place where some scholars argue that up to 500,000 people once lived, in what was one of the largest cities in Italy after Rome, and indeed one of the largest in the Roman Empire. This is the place in the world where there is the largest corpus of Roman inscriptions after Rome and Ostia.
I asked archaeologist Professor Catherine MacDonald to tell me all about these inscriptions,
asking her where these inscriptions are housed.
Most of the inscriptions are in one of the museums in Aquileia. So there's the National Archaeological Museum, which has the Roman material, and then there's the Paleo-Christian or Early Christian Museum, which has the Christian material. And both are filled with inscriptions partially because they were collected at a time in the 18th and 19th century when people normally collected inscriptions and then placed them in museums.
What do they tell us about the Romans?
Most of them are funerary. That's true for any site in the Roman Empire. But we have a few from Aquileia that talk about the early settlement or that are religious dedications or that mark important events in the history of the city, such as the revolt of Aquileia against Maximinus Thrax, different things. They tell me to a certain extent what family relationships were like, who commemorates whom, who builds a tomb for whom. They use a lot of adjectives to describe each other, so dearest daughter, devoted father, things that are very familiar to us from cemeteries today. And then I also use them to look at the ways in which people constructed their own identity. Roman cemeteries were just outside the city, so you walked through them coming in and out of town. So they were also a way in which you could advertise yourself, advertise your family, because the Romans built tombs about a third of the time for themselves while they were still alive. These are practices that to us seem a little odd, because at least the United States, we're so removed from thinking about the dead, except when someone dies. But for the Romans, there was a much more constant interaction with tombs. It's impossible, really, when you go there now to realize how large a city it was. Because now it's a small provincial town, lovely place to visit, easy to get around. A sleepy place, yeah. But it's as if, you know, as if Rome itself lay underneath a sleepy provincial town. And the resources and the time to excavate it comes intermittently.
So what about the basilica itself? The crypt within and the stunning mosaic floors dating back to early Christianity, late Roman times.
The basilica that we see now was built by Bishop Popo in the Ottonian era. Beneath it is a church, isn't quite the right word, but a Christian complex that dates to the 4th century AD, in fact, not long after Constantine becomes emperor in Rome. And it has mosaic floors that date back to that period, 4th century. That were excavated just before the First World War. Both of them have sort of geometric patterns. The one side, the geometric patterns are filled with animals, and there's been a lot of discussion as to whether or not there's direct Christian symbolism there, a question I think the Pope could probably answer better than I could. On the other side, there's a lovely depiction of the story of Jonah, from getting eaten by the whale to eventually his return under the fig tree. The whole narrative is laid out. And there's also images of the Good Shepherd and some donor portraits, people who paid for the mosaic, and an inscription that records its commissioning by the man who was bishop in the 4th century, a man named Theodore.
Well, believe it or not, inscriptions pitched up again in the conversation, so naturally I asked what their content was.
It says roughly that Theodore paid for this building and decoration to be made. It's fairly straightforward. But he says it twice. There's two different areas, and he refers to the beauty of what he created, too.
But these mosaics are in the basilica itself.
Yes. I think at that point, Aquileia was still under the Austrians, and they became interested in what was beneath the church and excavated it. So now what you see when you go in is they've put down a glass floor and walkway, and you walk along that, and you're looking at the 4th century floors. They don't directly correspond to the later church, but they correspond well enough that you can get a good view of most of the mosaics from the 4th century building.
Despite having been to Aquileia twice myself over the years, I was getting confused as to the different levels of the basilica. So I pressed Catherine for better explanation.
There's a church crypt, a crypt with relics, etc., which is under the front of the Ottonian church. And then there's something which they also call the crypt, which is these two rooms of the Christian complex, one which lies directly under the basilica, and then one which actually lies underneath the ground outside and underneath the bell tower. So when you're down looking at the mosaics, in one part you're actually underneath the campanile. You're actually down in this, what I would call a crypt area there. In the other area, you're under the church, and then the front of the church, just as in St. Peter's, there's a crypt with relics and frescoes.
Of course, one of the legendary things about Aquileia, one no longer visible, was the presence there of a mint. No ordinary mint, it seems.
Yes, it was set up by Diocletian. When he revises the provinces of the empire, so he divides up administration, he establishes a mint at Aquileia then, and it becomes one of the major mints for the Western Empire.
At this point, I was tempted to ask my archaeologist if she could fill me in more specifically on the Christian side of things regarding the basilica.
Aquileia was famous in Roman times for always taking the side of the rightful emperor. So when it came down to the battle between Constantine and Maxentius, they picked Maxentius' side, since legally he had been appointed the emperor of Italy and Constantine had been appointed the emperor of the northwestern provinces. So they take the wrong side, as it turns out. But Constantine doesn't punish the city for it. And eventually he passes through it, and the city is honored in various ways, and they honor him, of course, in various ways. Then it's important because the sons of Constantine, of course, since there are three of them, can never agree on who's in charge of what. And Constantine II and Constans actually battle for supremacy near Aquileia, which Constans wins. And actually it's at Aquileia when Julian the Apostate learns that Constantius has died and that he is now emperor. So there's quite a lot, actually, of 4th century history especially that happens right around that period. And of course it remains militarily important because it's one of the junctures between the East and West, both geographically and by sea.
Clearly, Aquileia takes on a central role then in the spread of Christianity.
Yeah, it does. And Aquileia plays an interesting role in what I would call the early medieval church. They split from Rome in the 7th century. There's a dispute. And they set up their own religious authority. They start to call themselves the patriarchs, as opposed to, say, the Pope in Rome or the patriarch in Constantinople. So very independent bishop princes. And even after they reconciliate with Rome, they keep the title of patriarch, which is how eventually we get a patriarch in Venice, because that's the title of the Aquilean bishop, which in 1450 becomes the title of the religious head in Venice.
And for Christians, I thought I'd ask, what not to miss in Aquileia? Well, Catherine told me the basilica, the mosaics of Jonah, the whale, and of course the Paleo-Christian Museum.
The early Christian museum is very interesting in Aquileia because it contains, they're mostly funerary inscriptions, again, but they're incised with drawings as well. So you see figures, orons, praying with their hands up, which I'm informed by my Italian friends people still do here. Americans rarely pray with their hands raised in the air. There's a lot of scenes of baptism. So early Christian iconography, very interesting on these tombs because of the variety of scenes. Figures of the crucifixion, I think, if I remember correctly. And there's also a relief there that's supposed to be a depiction of Peter and Paul that's very early.
And my thanks there go to Professor Catherine McDonnell, who teaches Roman archaeology at the University of California, Los Angeles, with a particular expertise in the Roman Empire. Now for the third and final part of a series presented by renowned preacher and poet, Father Paul Murray, who belongs to the Irish province of the Order of Preachers. In the course of his life, Father Paul has addressed many an audience. But in November, his words reached an unusual group of listeners, the members of the House of Lords. To them, he spoke not of politics, but of contemplation, as an essential ingredient in Christian tradition. The talk, organised by the Royal Fine Art Commission Trust in conjunction with Sky Television that filmed the event, marked a first for the House of Lords. A Dominican friar had never been seen there before. In a few moments, then, you can hear the last in our three-part radio adaptation of this talk, one which, quoting Father Paul's words, I chose to call, "What is it like to come close to the presence of God?"
What is it like to come close to the presence of God? One of the most common images used by the saints and the great contemplatives to describe the journey to God is that of an arduous climb up a high mountain, the image of an ascent. But I've been suggesting in these talks that there is another way of thinking about this subject, a different image given to us by the saints. An image not of going up higher and higher in the spirit, but rather an image of going down, an image of a humble descent, an image even of falling. And progress on this path can be thought of as taking place, I suggest, in three stages. First, falling into sin. Second, falling towards grace. And third, falling in love with God. Having already, in the earlier talks, considered the first two stages, the focus of our attention now will be on the third and final stage, falling in love with God. The spiritual progress described so far has been one of healing and purification. God has allowed us to be stripped of the pride we have had in our own righteousness, the purpose being that when in nakedness of spirit and vulnerability, we at last fall back on Him, His touch is felt by us as never before. And by virtue of that touch, we know ourselves to have entered into a new realm of grace, into a new awareness. We are drawn to Him as to a friend, to someone we love. Indeed, writes one of the early fathers of the Church, the soul is led by a heavenly love and desire when once the beauty and glory of the Word of God has been perceived. The soul falls in love with His splendor, and by this receives from Him some dart and wound of love. An unforgettable moment of such wounding occurs in John of the Cross's celebrated poem, The Spiritual Canticle. At a certain stage in the poem, the bride, who represents the soul, is made aware that at last her beloved is present, and at once, quickened to joy by the thought of his arrival and by the strength and beauty of his presence, she exclaims, "My beloved, the mountains, the solitary wooded valleys, the strange islands, the resounding rivers, the whisper of the loving breezes, the tranquil night. At the time of the rising of the dawn, the silent music, the sounding solitude, the supper that refreshes
and awakens love. Writing some years earlier, in one of his prose commentaries, St. John explains that the acts of love which arise from the heart of the contemplative on these occasions are of such astonishing worth in the eyes of God that even one of them is more valuable than all the deeds that a person may have performed in his or her whole life, no matter how great those deeds may have been. Of course, what is being described here by St. John is contemplative experience at the highest level. That does not mean, however, in the context of our own efforts at prayer, that God does not take delight in even the most humble acts of love. For corresponding to the high mystical woundings or touches that quicken love in the hearts of the great contemplatives, there are other blessings and graces of the divine presence and of the divine touch, which even the least of us, on occasion, are privileged to experience. And not to be forgotten also are those moments of natural mysticism, which can sometimes awaken in both believer and unbeliever a sense of the transcendent. T.S. Eliot calls them moments in and out of time. He writes, "The distraction fit, lost in a shaft of sunlight, the wild time unseen, or the winter lightning, or the waterfall, or music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all, but you are the music while the music lasts." How impressively, in those last few lines, Eliot evokes the power of music. And music, or certain forms of religious music, might well be a really good way to introduce the subject of Christian prayer and contemplation, especially to those who have no knowledge whatever of the Christian faith. For music, in an almost miraculous way, can communicate at times not only aspects of the meaning, but also something of the innermost beauty of Christian prayer. One has only to think, for example, of the great choral music of the Russian Orthodox liturgy, or of the singing of Latin plain chant in monasteries in Europe and across the world, or of the music sung by King's College Choir in Cambridge, or of the music composed for Christian feasts and celebrations by Bach and Thales, Byrd and Palestrina, and by so many others. Hearing music of this kind can, I suggest, have almost the same impact on us as taking time to read some of the great mystical texts in the Christian tradition. Our inner heart is quickened and awakened. We find ourselves being instinctively drawn forward by the beauty of the sound and by the beauty of truth, drawn while the music lasts, to give our full and rapt attention to even the least echo of the eternal word, the least trace of the source of all beauty, the God whom Hopkins calls beauty's self and beauty's giver. This God, a God not only of truth and of goodness, but of beauty, was of course the God who in the end so completely captivated the mind and heart of Augustine. For beauty, in its different forms, was the one thing which had always obsessed him as a man, both before and after his conversion. At one point in the Confessions, in a passage which is justly celebrated, we find Augustine reflecting on that divine love, which not only intervened to save him, but which in the end absolutely overwhelmed him with its beauty. It's a passage that contains what must surely be one of the most moving descriptions of falling in love with God ever written. I am happy now to read it for you and to bring to an end these few reflections on Christian prayer and contemplation. Late, late have I loved you, O beauty, ever ancient and ever new. You were within me, and I was in the world outside myself. I searched for you outside myself, and, disfigured as I was, I fell upon the lovely things of your creation. You were with me, but I was not with you. You called me. You cried aloud to me. You broke my barrier of deafness. You shone upon me. Your radiance enveloped me. You put my blindness to flight. You shed your fragrance about me. I drew breath, and now I gasp for your sweet odor. I tasted you, and now I hunger and thirst for you. You touched me, and now I burn for your peace.
You were listening there to renowned preacher and poet Father Paul Murray, who belongs to the Irish province of the Order of Preachers. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. So do join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.